If you've been to my office for evaluation of ADHD, then what you've experienced is a psychiatric interview. ADHD, can be diagnosed by psychiatric interview, and we're going to go through that process in this recording. ADHD can also be diagnosed with psychological testing. And so psychological testing is fairly accurate. On the other hand, there are some cases of ADHD that are not really easy to pin down. And at that time, I do believe that psychiatric interview is going to be better than psychological testing. The reason is that in a psychiatric interview, the psychiatrist is getting to know the patient. The psychiatrist is taking into account other psychiatric conditions that may be going on, such as anxiety and depression. But then going a bit deeper, we're looking at stress. We're looking at the possibility of bipolar disorder, maybe hypomania. And that diagnostic process, again, is, I believe, better done by a well-trained psychiatrist, and I would add a psychiatrist who really understands ADHD. There are many people in the mental health field, both psychologists, but I'm really referring to those of us who are considered providers, psychiatrists, and psychiatric nurse practitioners. I believe, for the most part, really do not understand ADHD as well as they should. In fact, it is a proven research statistic that ADHD is very neglected, a strong word, but that's what the statistics actually show, that in half of psychiatric practices, half of mental health clinics, ADHD is not really taken into account. Of course, if it's obvious in hyperactive children or in adults whose primary complaint is, I just can't stay focused, then of course, diagnostically, most any of us, we'll think of ADHD and weave that into the diagnostic interview. However, I believe that ADHD is something to be understood way beyond the prescribing of medication. And so I would want you to keep in mind whoever is evaluating your ADHD. That person really should have some experience in the area in order for that interview to be a good diagnostic interview. Getting back to psychological testing, testing is a matter of asking a ton of questions. There is intelligence testing done. There are questionnaires given to teachers and family members, and all of that is taken into account. So there are more questions asked in a psychological interview, but then the question becomes, how many questions do you really need to ask to diagnose ADHD? So I'm going to run through with you the basics of what a psychiatrist is normally going to do in a psychiatric interview for or diagnostic interview for ADHD. I believe it starts in childhood. Now, I have many adults coming into my practice who were not diagnosed with ADHD as a child. Nevertheless, according to our diagnostic criteria, we should be looking for evidence that it was there before the age of 12. So, before the age of 12, the most reliable period of time is going to be in middle school. Middle school is about age 12, grade 6. So, Great. Before that, a child who's hyperactive may obviously have ADHD, but the child who is not hyperactive is one who may be smart enough to be succeeding in school and therefore not attract any attention in this sense of ADHD. So, with boys, for instance, boys can be smart, they can be interested, they can be at the same time getting up out of their seat, interrupting the teacher, but still, because they want to please the teacher, they may very well be getting the work done. And so, again, that boy who does have a focus problem might not come to, might not have enough ADHD to attract attention. Likewise, a girl normally is going to be either very talkative and therefore getting out of her seat, interrupting the teacher, talk, 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 or dreamy. So the teacher might, for instance, report to the parents that, she just seems to be dreamy, staring out the window, daydreaming a lot, not getting her work done. And so we do look for that difference between boys and girls. Then, at about those ages of 10 to 12, at least this was the case with my children, they were expected to start organizing themselves and being accountable for their work and handing in their work. Whereas before that age, they were told everything to do and reminded of everything. So at that age, when they are expected to develop their own organizational skills and be more accountable, and that being the middle school age, they will often come to attention for that reason. So the high school student with ADHD may very well gravitate toward sports. And then, so then school is secondary. Not that sports means ADHD, but that a very important principle in understanding ADHD is that we thrive when we're having fun. I say we because I've finally decided that I have a mild degree of it myself, and because I do, I believe I live it and I understand it more than most. So in this then again, back to the high school student will be drawn toward fun, and often that is the extracurricular activities. On the other hand, that student may be doing very well in classes that he or she really enjoys. We focus well when we're having fun, is the rule, and not so well in the classes that are either boring or otherwise very uninteresting or seemingly irrelevant. So I believe that that interest level is something that's kind of accepted by the student, that is a teacher or a class is either interesting or it's not. There's nothing they can do about it. But in fact, there is. And we will talk more about that in videos about academic success with ADHD. But the preview on that is, again, that we focus well when we're having fun. So there is a way to adjust one's attitude and decide to have fun learning everything. Again, more about that later. So then there is a pattern of ADHD that comes out in the college student that should attract attention and otherwise make one think about ADHD. And that pattern goes like this. The ADHD student, again, is usually smart. He knows it, she knows it, and in school, they have learned that it's a little harder for them to get those grades to show up on the report cards the way other smart students seem to be able to. So then we try harder. And so then beginning a college semester, and this is the pattern that I want to describe, we're gung-ho at the beginning of the semester. This is great. I'm going to be excited about all my classes. I'm going to, you know, do this and do that, and I'm going to be really successful with it. And so at that point, that energy and drive and the fun factor works, and it works for a few weeks, maybe 6 weeks. So think about it. If a college semester begins the middle of August, then by the end of September, that student has been, you know, into it for 6 weeks, and the novelty may be wearing off. The energy, the drive, the enthusiasm may be wearing down. And oh, by the way, there are lots of distractions on a college campus in the fall, and we all know what those are. And so then students can again go where the fun is and take their eye off the ball in terms of their academic achievements. And so I encourage students to make sure that they're having as much fun in their academic pursuits as they are in their extracurricular activities. I believe it's a matter of awareness, that once you make the student aware that those temptations could really have unanticipated consequences, that again, that awareness of the pattern tends to prevent the pattern from playing out. How would it play out? Well, after that first 6 weeks, what easily happens is the grades start to slide, and they slide from, let's say, the 1st of October until right before Thanksgiving. That's another 6 weeks. And as the students see those grades gradually falling, then they become rather alarmed right before Thanksgiving and might even spend their Thanksgiving vacation catching up, essentially trying to rescue their grades. A lot of them will pull it off because by that point you still have about 3, maybe 4 weeks in order to turn things around, get caught up on your work, focus really hard on what the final grade is going to be, and again they'll pull it out. So lots of times they don't really get the pattern. They instead think they're floundering. They don't know why. They don't know what's going on. They have lost interest because the failures or those feelings of inadequacy that come up with grades that are dropping is enough to take all the fun out of it. And so when that happens, then you've got a real problem. You've got a student who isn't interested in college anymore and doesn't know what the problem is, and therefore doesn't know that what he really needs to do is re-engage that positive attitude toward studies and rescue that grade. So again, very important pattern in college students who have ADHD. So we're diagnosing ADHD in this interview, and yet I wanted to point out that before we get into the real meat of this recording, is that history, primarily of academic success, academic patterns, I should say, that history is important to the diagnosis. So now what I want to do is to go through a questionnaire that we use quite actively in my practice. And so there are 20 items on this questionnaire. And so we go through them rather quickly. In fact, I will say to a patient, we're going to go through this quickly. The question is, does each of these items apply to you, yes or no? There are no maybes and no discussion until after we're done, and then yes, we'll circle back around and talk about the patterns that we see. So it isn't just a questionnaire, it isn't just a screener, although it could be used for that, but we actually use it as a template of sorts to discuss the various aspects of ADHD, thereby continuing that diagnostic conversational interview. So again, does each of these apply to you, yes or no? So number one, a sense of underachievement, of not meeting one's goals in life, regardless of how much one has actually accomplished. Now, I said no discussion, but I'm gonna break my own rule here. This is a questionnaire which I believe is best taken by a young adult, age 25 or so. And the reason for that is that some of these questions are just simply not going to be developmentally appropriate to, for instance, a graduating high school student, because that student may not have had a sense of underachievement by that point in life. Likewise, an adult who's 45 might have actually compensated for weaknesses. That is, as adults, we do compensate for our weaknesses. We do that somewhat unconsciously and automatically because we have to succeed. We have to succeed as adults. And usually we're also driven to succeed in careers. So again, keep in mind the developmentally appropriate age for this questionnaire, and I'll highlight that as we go. So again, a sense of underachievement is something that most anybody could have. What is that? A sense of underachievement. It means I don't think that I'm accomplishing as much as I'm capable of. Yes or no? Secondly, difficulty getting organized. Yes or no? Chronic procrastination or trouble getting started, meaning you put things off and other things that you want to start, you just don't get started on them. Many projects going simultaneously, trouble with follow through, or a tendency not to finish them. So these three are grouped together because they are organizational in nature. Again, we will come back to this grouping after we get through the questionnaire. So then I've grouped 5, 12, and 18 together because these, so let's just go through them, all right? Does number 5 apply to you, yes or no? A tendency to say what comes to mind without necessarily considering the timing or the appropriateness of the remark. Number 12, impulsive, a tendency to say or do things without thinking, as if you couldn't catch yourself. And 18, a tendency toward addictive behavior. A tendency toward addictive behavior is impulsive. All right. Number 6, a frequent search for high stimulation, always looking for the next fun thing to do. Now, this might sound like the adrenaline junkie, but I'm asking you to look for a pattern. Frequent search for high stimulation actually means, what can I do that's fun? There's a tendency to put things off that might be important, but they're not much fun. And so then, oh my gosh, do I have to do that now? Maybe I can justify putting that off, doing that tomorrow. Meanwhile, there's this other thing over here that I really like to do. And so again, we gravitate toward things that are fun. So that's number 6. Number 7, an intolerance of boredom. Number 10 is a trouble in going through established channels and following proper procedure. What does that mean? Well, imagine buying something at Lowe's that needs to be assembled. And so then you open the box and you just kind of go about putting the parts together. And then you get 95% finished with it and realize you don't have one of the parts. That happened to me once. That was a wagon to use at the barn. And so I got almost to the end of it, realized I didn't have a crucial part. So I had to put everything in a bag so I could keep it together. And then it never got finished. I never ordered the thing because I was busy, and apparently it wasn't that important anyway. And so then, you know, years later, when I sold the place, I threw out that bag of stuff. Going through proper procedure, it can be something as simple as assembling something, or it can be another example. Let's imagine in the workplace that you need an answer to something, and you feel a sense of urgency. You need it now, and you know that your boss's boss is the one with the answer. So you just go over heads in order to get it, and then those people who weren't involved are a bit put off that you didn't ask them first. So again, following proper procedure, having the patience to do that, having the sense of organization to do that. That's what number 10 means. And number 11, impatient with a low tolerance of frustration. Yes or no? Number 8 is probably the most important one in the questionnaire, because this is the focus question. Are you easily distracted, trouble focusing attention, a tendency to drift out, tune out or drift away in the middle of a page or a conversation? So for instance, in a conversation, you just kind of zone out, and the person who's talking to you just thinks you're not interested, particularly you're not interested in her, and she takes it personally. Or you're reading a book, and you know, you read a paragraph and your mind has wandered, and by the end of the paragraph you're thinking, I don't know what I just read, so you have to read it again. And when that doesn't work, then you have to slap yourself on the head and say focus, in order to really zero in and read that well enough to remember what you've read. Very common problem with ADHD. Number 9 is the one in the questionnaire that's not a symptom. That people with ADHD are unusually creative. We are sensitive and intuitive and often highly intelligent. Yes or no? 14, a tendency to worry needlessly and endlessly, to worry about something all the time. So normally this one item would be that bottom line description of a generalized anxiety disorder, a tendency to worry needlessly, endlessly, excessively. That's generalized anxiety disorder. Those of us with ADHD do have a tendency to worry more. And I believe that part of the explanation for that is that we are creative, and also a bit hyperactive, so things circle around in our minds over and over and over again, and because we're creative, we actually think of reasons not to resolve that problem, or to continue thinking about it, or to obsess on it, or to hyper focus on it, so we might not reassure ourselves or otherwise resolve the worry as easily or as readily as those who don't have ADHD. Number 15 and 19 are somewhat related, a sense of insecurity and problems with self-esteem. Now, of course, these two can have other explanations besides ADHD, as can many of the items on this questionnaire. But normally, we look for that sense of insecurity because of not quite fitting in, not quite performing up to others' expectations. Starts again in the school system or with parents, and for that matter, as adults, we can be in relationships with people who think that we just need to try harder to be normal, and that again fuels those feelings of inadequacy. More on that later. Chronic problems with self-esteem is pretty much the same thing. Mood swings or rapidly changing moods, especially when disengaged from a person or a project. What this item actually refers to, it can be somewhat complicated, But the simple thing to realize is that those of us with ADHD have first what we call a rejection sensitivity problem, and that's been described as a rejection sensitivity dysphoria, as if it's a new thing and that to be talked about and understood. Well, it's always been a part of ADHD. The way it works is that if we are rejected or disappointed, or someone is disapproving, then we not only get down about it, but we get down a little too much and can kind of be down about it all day long, more than the situation would normally call for. You know, the person who would just let it roll off or use it as a way to kind of be determined to fix that or correct that, we have a mood problem more than most. And the same thing could happen in reverse. We can get so excited, you know, you're really into something. And at this point, the mind's going fast and feels really good. We're getting that dopamine burst, and that can look hypomanic or manic. Hypomania, having mentioned it, is a toned down version of mania, such that the person's not really manic, but it's as if they look like it because their energy is up and they're, you know, doing a lot of stuff, and they look like they're not quite thinking things through. In that diagnostic interview, you know, we're going to screen for hypomania, and we're going to discuss how that can look a lot like an ADHD pattern of simply getting really excited and hyper-focused on something that's, again, very enjoyable and getting our dopamine levels going. Physical or mental restlessness. Again, this is an adult ADHD questionnaire that we're going through. A child who is hyperactive will be obvious. Most of us have some degree of hyperactivity. And as adults, it is very much mental. That is, it's inside the head. It's not that noticeable physically. Yes, there are people who, you know, tap their foot and shake their leg and, you know, do other things that are somewhat hyperactive, but all that's very mild. And yet there's this very real sense of restlessness inside the head. And then lastly, people with ADHD usually do have a family history. People will ask, you know, can you inherit it? Yes, absolutely. There's a very strong inheritance pattern. Now, when we talk about genetics and inheritance, it's not as if there's this discussion about inheriting blue eyes versus brown eyes, and that's a real simple genetic pattern to discuss. That is not what we're talking about here. But if I have someone sitting in front of me who clearly has ADHD, then I'm going to wonder where that came from. Usually one of the parents has it. So there's that. Mood disorders can have ADHD. So let me acquaint you with the term comorbid. Comorbid means that there is another disorder that is going on at the same time. And those two might easily be overlapping and even confusing in terms of symptoms that might easily fit under either category. And so that's the case with mood disorders. People with bipolar disorder often have trouble focusing. Some of them should be diagnosed with ADHD. Likewise, there are people with ADHD who can become hypomanic. And So the point being that there's somewhat of a spectrum there. Substance abuse, yes. Substance abuse, think of it as something that the person really doesn't think through. They go for the high, they go for the fun, but they don't want to think about the consequences or the potential consequences. And so that can fit an ADHD pattern, and therefore those with ADHD do have a higher incidence of substance abuse, and likewise, people with substance abuse issues may easily have ADHD behind it. Impulse control disorders, think of hair pulling, or picking. Those are, it's kind of a different category, but it can easily reflect kind of a hyperactivity and a discharge of the hyperactivity that's kind of being channeled into an area that's described as an impulse control disorder. But again, maybe ADHD patterns would tend to explain it. So if there is a family history of any of this, then the person, the patient is at a higher risk for having ADHD if these things are going on in the family. All right. So in this discussion, we're diagnosing ADHD. And what we do normally is circle back around and talk about these things, these items in the questionnaire, in much the same way that I've just explained them to you. There were a couple of times when I said we'll come back to that later, but I think you get the general idea that when there is a childhood history, and then when the adult says yes to most of these, and we actually tend to score it. Number 9 is the only one on the list that's not a symptom. That's the creative, intuitive, often highly intelligent item. That's not a symptom, but it's a very important part of the ADHD diagnosis, because I believe, and we'll get to this soon, we're going to talk about a list of famous people with ADHD. I'm going to argue that there are those whose success happened because they had ADHD, because they were creative, or because they were intuitive and had the intelligence then to well, create or invent or perform brilliantly. So in conclusion, this is generally speaking the way we're going to go through an initial ADHD diagnosis in an adult. Of course, it's a little bit different with children, and yet this particular video is to help adults to understand ADHD, and for those who've been to my office to be reminded of these patterns that they may wish to discuss with us further. All right, so that would be the end of this video. Thank you for watching. Hope you learned a few things. So a final thought about this questionnaire would be to give credit where credit is due. I've been using this questionnaire in my practice for at least the last 15 years. And I think it probably originated from the work of Drs. Halliwell and Rady, who wrote Delivered from Distraction. And then 10 years later, Delivered from Distraction. Did I say that right? Driven to Distraction, and then Delivered from Distraction. And so Delivered from Distraction was the number one recommendation for reading about ADHD in my practice all these years, until recently, when they published their updated version called ADHD 2.0. So we recommend this reading to everyone. It is by far it's enjoyable. It is experienced. It is, I believe, the most helpful book for understanding ADHD in a way that's positive and helpful. The same doctors also publish an online magazine called Attitude, which I would also recommend. A word of caution, a lot of what you're going to see about ADHD describes a problem that can be medicated. And I will argue over and over again that those of us with mild degrees of ADHD should probably not look at ADHD as a problem as much as it is an opportunity. An opportunity to not just be different, but to exploit those differences. And we'll discuss that in other videos. But I did want to highlight the work of Dr. Hallowell and Dr. Rady, particularly as it regards this questionnaire. Again, I'm not sure it came from them, but I think it might have. So there you have it.